Get ready for all the craziness of small business. It's exactly that craziness that makes it exciting and totally unbelievable. Small Business Radio is now on the air with your host, Barry Maltz.
Well, thanks for joining this week's radio show. And remember, this is the final word in small business. For those keeping track, this is now eye-catchingly show number 514. This show is sponsored by Nextiva, the all-in-one communication solution for your small business. Well, every small business owner struggles with ethics. If they don't, then I believe that they're just kidding themselves. When I started my third business, my partner and I had a long conversation about how we would handle various ethical choices that would come up. And I have to tell you, we actually failed at so many turns to meet our own ethical standards because of all the pressures of running our business. So there are so many times ethical bumps up against money and, be quite honest, greed. So what will ultimately win? My first guest is Jim Blasingame. He's one of the world's leading experts on small business entrepreneurship. He's the creator and award-winning host of the syndicated weekday radio program called The Small Business Advocate Show since 1997. He just released his fourth book. It's called The Third Ingredient. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Barry. It's good to be on your show. Good to turn the table.
Well, I just said I was on show number 514. You must be on show 434, or actually 400,034.
Yeah, 1,000 live interviews a year.
Wow, unbelievable. So tell me about, you talked to so many different people. What was the inspiration for this new book called The Third Ingredient?
Well, the thing that I started noticing, Barry, as I'm sure you did too, was that technology and not just the internet, but technology and the internet was changing the pace of things, changing the speed of things, and the way people were getting their information, and also the power of information, the how information, more than money and stuff, that information was becoming, you know, a real asset or something that you could lever. And so I started to notice, the first thing I noticed was how customers were changing, and that caused me to write my third book, The Age of the Customer. But the same paradigm shift, and I use that word very specifically. I'm calling what we're going through right now, we're in the middle, you and I are literally in the middle of paradigm shift, 10,000 year paradigm shift that's never happened before. It's one of the reasons why we should cut ourselves a little bit of slack when we're a little bit anxious, a little bit confused, a little frustrated about how fast things are going. We probably ought to cut ourselves a little bit of a slack because our grandparents didn't have to go through these kinds of changes. And so things are moving so fast, transitioning from the 20th century marketplace to the 21st century, from the old to the new. And right now, all the things I just said is also impacting not only how we do business with customers, but how we treat each other. And the shift that we're seeing right now that this new book's about is the shift between what I call analog ethics and digital ethics. Now, I didn't coin the term digital ethics, but apparently I coined the term analog ethics because, in my opinion, Barry, you can't really understand where we got to go with our digital ethics unless you're prepared to define and understand what I'm calling analog ethics, which is everything that we've learned the last 10,000 years.
You know, it's so interesting to me, and I think it's a great subject for a book, because I always thought, Jim, that when the internet came out, we would finally have the arbitrator of the truth. If we want to know what was the truth, we just looked up on the internet. But now you can find any truth you want on the internet, and there's so much misinformation out there that, as you said, analog ethics no longer really apply because there is no longer a real arbitrator of the truth.
Well, here's the thing, and you reminded me of it earlier when you talked about the difficulty that all of us go through when we leave our parents' homes and our Sunday school classes and kindergarten, and we go into the marketplace. What we learn is that ethics is not black and white. Mm-hmm. Ethics is not a lie or the truth. Ethics is gray, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
That's not to say that you can be. Subjective about whether it's the right thing to do or a wrong thing to do. It's just that in the marketplace, everything is not binary. It's not either yes or no, right or wrong.
It's so interesting to me, Jim, because I always say, you know, and I've written about this, wrote about this a lot in my first book, You Need to Be a Little Crazy, about the ethical challenges I face in running my first business. I always said, listen, ethically, I'm an 8 trying to be a 9. I'm never going to be a 10.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we all strive to be better at that. But you know, an example of why ethics are gray is if you called me right now and said, hey, Jim, I need this new product that I need more of what you're selling me. When can you deliver it? And I know I've got a brand new product coming out January 3rd. And you say to me, I need this right now. Well, am I obligated to tell you about that brand new product? Or you told me you want it right now. What should I say? And so I could deliver a product right now and close out my year with it. But because that's what you asked for. But whose ethics, everyone's ethics are a little bit different in this case. You might say, well, Barry, I got a brand new version of this coming out in January. Can you wait? That would be an ethical thing to do, wouldn't it? But you don't have to because you said you wanted it now.
So what advice do you give to, and you know, you listen, you talk to small business owners all the time, especially ones that are just starting out. What advice do you give to them, Jim, about the challenge they're going to face when it comes to ethically running their business and the pressures, the real pressures they're going to face that are going to challenge everything they think they know?
Well, the things that I'm concerned about, Barry, are not the ethics that you and I grew up with, the 10,000-year catalog of magnificent ethics and what I call passive forces, which includes the laws like the Magna Carta, like the Bill of Rights, like the Constitution, laws, regulations, money, currency is a passive force. These are all things that you and I created, our forebears created over 10,000 years to hold fear and greed in equilibrium. And we've done a pretty good job of that. But Barry, that was in the analog age. That was back when our fear and greed didn't move any faster than our passive forces. When we were able to pass laws to hold fear and greed in check. But you and I both know that we're in the digital age now. And the digital things that are moving in the digital age are moving faster than our analog ethics. And the point of the book, and this is what I'm trying to help small business owners, well, everyone really understand, is that we can no longer expect the way we have practiced our ethics. We can no longer expect it to keep pace with the digital age because things are moving too fast. We have not yet figured out how to put trust on a 9 gigahertz nitrogen-cooled 32-core processor.
Right.
We haven't figured that out yet. We're working on it, and I've got some ideas. In the book, I talk about some things that I think we can do to make that happen, and that's what I call the third ingredient. That's the reason I titled my book that way, Barry. The third ingredient becomes the co-equal force of digital fear and greed. Whatever we come up with, it's going to have something that's rooted in our analog ethics, but powered by technology. It's got to be rooted in analog ethics. It's got to be powered by technology. Because remember, Barry, 100 years from now, when you and I are gone and our grandchildren are in the marketplace, they're going to be 100% in the digital age, and they're not going to be any less analog than you and I are.
So, Jim, what tools do we have or do you suggest that we can deal with this change? Because I think it's a very real threat that's out there.
Well, the things that we can do are, there are a couple of things we can do that are pretty simple. First, make sure that you become a more conscientious, a more discerning consumer, not only of information, but also of the technology that we use. If there's an app, remember the Cambridge Analytica debacle? Remember
that? How can we forget?
Look at everything. Well, guess what? I bet you $100 that app that all those people downloaded, I bet you $100 it had a little notice in there that says, if you download my app, I'm going to come and get all your stuff.
Right.
Because I've got apps on my phone that would like to have that, but I won't give it to them. I won't download those apps. They would like to download on my phone, but I won't because it said, I'm going to come get all your contacts, all your emails and everything. When I know that app doesn't need that. And so I say no. And so the thing I'm asking people to do is to say to themselves, whenever they see something that looks pretty sexy, but it's obviously going to encroach on them, I'm saying to them to say to yourself, just because I can doesn't mean that I should. That's one thing that we have to do. The other thing we have to do is we have to demand of the people we do business with. We're going to have to start demanding this of Facebook, of Google, of Twitter, of Amazon. We're going to have to start demanding of those people that they demonstrate digital ethics. And if they don't, we stop doing business with them. We don't buy their stocks. Regular folks, Barry, are going to have to – the government is not going to regulate Facebook. Users, customers are going to have to regulate Facebook. The problem is we've never had to deal – we've never had – as individuals, we've never had to be as forceful for ethics in the past as we have as we are now. Because when you and I – Barry, you and I have known each other a long time. We've been, we've been ethical with each other for a long time, but that was in an ethical world. I'm sorry, an analog world. We're now in a digital age, and we have to be more granular. We have to be more individuals about demanding ethical behavior, not just of you and me. I'm not worried about Barry. I'm worried about Jeff Bezos and Facebook and those guys.
So, Jim, do you think we've gotten to this place because it's so easy to do things either automatically or anonymously in a digital world versus in an analog world, you actually had to stand there and you actually had to say it. You had to be present. But now the internet makes it so easy just to do it and no one knows actually who you are, or it can just be done in the background.
That's an excellent point, and that's another. Now you're coming back to my first point earlier, Barry, when I said we have to realize that when you hit an enter key, well, think about this, Barry. One of the first things you played with was probably a truck or a hammer, right?
Absolutely, both of them.
Out in the yard getting dirty. Well, but those were levers. That was levers. That was analog leverage. So nobody ever gave you a hammer and gave you instructions on how to use the hammer or how not to use it, right?
Right.
Because whatever your ethical behavior was, you delivered your ethical behavior with that hammer or with the steering wheel of a vehicle. But now that you're pushing a button, an enter key on a smartphone or a computer, and can influence things on the other side of the planet, we all have more responsibility for our own digital leverage, for our own leverage and our own ethical behavior. We have that kind of individual responsibility that we've never had before. And that's the point in my book. I'm trying to help people to understand that this is not like 100 years ago. I've actually had people say, oh, this will work itself out. We've gone through these transitions before. And Barry, I'm telling them, you're wrong. This is different. This is not like the turn of the 20th century. What do you think?
No, I think you're totally true, because what happens is what you say online now can spread so much quickly, so much farther than it ever could. And that's how misinformation just spreads
that's
so
right.
quickly. But I guess my question to you, Jim,
right.
is what is digital trust going to look like, and who's going to be the arbitrator of that?
Digital trust is going to be a combination of what I said a minute ago. It's going to be rooted in our analog ethics, what you and I as analog beings. See, remember this, Barry, you and I are always going to demand trust. We're always going to require trust. Wherever we go, whatever world we're living in, digital or analog or quantum, we, as analog beings, which we're always going to be, we always have been, we're always going to be analog beings, we're always, by nature, by definition, we're always going to require trust. The difference is that we're going to have a different way of delivering trust that we can trust. Deliberate doing business in a way that we can trust that moves at 186,000 miles per second, doing nine bits per second, and nine billion bits per second, I should say. And we're going to have to find a way to do business at that speed. And here's one thing that I want to get across to folks that I'd like for them to write down, Barry. This is going to be on the test. Your ethics has always moved at the speed of your leverage. Remember what I said about the hammer and the steering wheel earlier? Wherever you were, Barry, your ethics were right there with you. And wherever you moved to, whatever you did, your ethics were always nearby, right? They were in you. Your ethics were the extension of your hand. Because as you said earlier, we're now pushing buttons and doing things on the other side of the planet in a split second. We have to recognize that our ethics have got to find a way to move that fast. We have to make our digital ethics move at the same speed as our digital leverage. And that's going to take a piece of technology, some technology that's empowering our analog ethics. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a tip here, Barry. I think it's going to be some variation on blockchain.
Hmm.
I'm not going to say it's blockchain, but it's going to be a variation on blockchain.
Well, Jim, I think in the meantime, we all have to be incredibly much more responsible and realize that our actions can be leveraged by so many others. The title of the book is called The Third Ingredient. Jim, where can people get in touch with you and listen to your unbelievable show?
smallbusinessadvocate.com is the website. The book is The Third Ingredient with the number 3.com. Amazon has it. Contact me and you want an autographed copy, we'll give you a discount and send you an autographed copy. And Barry, I'm so proud of you for what you've been doing with your show. It's a great show, and keep up the good work. You know how much I love what you're doing, and let's get you back on my show real soon.
Listen, my only goal in life is to grow up and be you, Jim, so I appreciate that. This is AM 820 WCPT in Chicago. We'll be right back. I know a lot of small business owners are confused about where to advertise online and how to actually get results. You gotta be diligent because you can lose a lot of money fast if you don't choose the right platform and the right audience. The question I always get is, should I advertise on a search engine like Google or a social media platform like LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter? For small business owners, LinkedIn is the place to drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term, purposeful relationships that result in boosting their business. This is because effective search engine advertising should target audiences, not keywords. LinkedIn's network has more than 575 members, and their advertising gives you the ability to effectively target the right message to the right people while they're working. It has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to their job title, company name, and industry. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers who are on LinkedIn are decision makers at their company, so you're building relationships with the people that really matter. This will result in higher quality leads and more website traffic. So to redeem a $100 free LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, please use this website for listeners of Small Business Radio Show. You got to go to linkedin.com/SBR. That's linkedin.com/SBR for your free $100 ad credit. Remember that terms and conditions apply. Let me know about your results.
You've already upgraded your cell phone to a smart device, which lets you use the internet to be more productive on the go. But what about your desk phone? Nextiva. Is a smart business phone system in the cloud. With a simple setup through an internet connection, you can soon have access to your office communications wherever you are. Stay seamlessly connected with clients and stay more mobile than ever before with just one low monthly cost. Give your business more than just a basic desk phone. Visit Nextiva.com or call 800-799-0600 to learn more today. Nextiva. Simplifying your business communications.
Are you stuck? Is this the year you finally grow your business and make more money? During Barry's many years of running his own company, he had to deal with the challenges of a business that just wasn't going anywhere. It was a painful realization. His business had flatlined, and he had no idea how to breathe more life into it. It was especially difficult for Barry, since his customers were not getting the service he was so passionate about delivering. Second, he wasn't making any money. Finally, his business was sucking the life out of him. Do any of these sound familiar? Your sales won't budge in spite of your best efforts. You have few new leads for customers coming in, and existing customers are fading away. You're burned out and completely exhausted. It's no longer fun, and your family suffers as well. If you're one of the millions of small business owners facing these problems every year, Barry has the answer. Check out BarryMoltz.com/unstuck to subscribe to his 6-part video series. That's BarryMoltz, MOLTZ.com/unstuck.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, we're going to consider a question that I've never, ever asked in the over 500 shows of Small Business Radio, and that is, can poetry actually help you in small business? My next guest is David J.P. Fisher, also known as D-Fish. He's a speaker, coach, and author of 8 books, including the best-selling Hyper-Connected Selling and Networking in the 21st Century, Why Your Net Worth Sucks and What to Do About It. He's just came out with a new book. It's called 575, A Daily Glimpse of Chicago Life Seen Through Haiku. He lives in Evanston, Illinois, next to a huge cemetery that he says helps him appreciate the value every day. David, welcome to the show.
Barry, thanks for having me so much.
All right,
excited
so let's consider this question that we've never, ever considered. Well, actually, first, let's consider a question before. Why does a business author write poetry?
I'm still asking myself that question. You know, it was actually a really fun exercise. I've always done creative writing. I wrote poetry in my youth. And I wanted to, after writing, you know, a bunch of books, a bunch of business articles, I really felt I wasn't being honest to that creative side of myself. So I was like, how can I actually bring that back into my life? And, you know, writing haiku, you know, writing 17 syllables was doable, right? in my day, in between all the other things I had to do. So that's how I got into it. And I just did one a day for a year.
You know, it's so interesting to me because I think small business owners are so quick to write off the really creative side of them, which seemingly has nothing to do with their business. But ultimately, if they would just allow it in, then it really can make an impact into shaping their company.
100%. I think one of the biggest mistakes we make about creativity is that we think it has to be about art or music, you know, something that, again, only an artist would do. But to be an entrepreneur, to be a small business person is inherently creative. You're making something out of nothing. There was nothing there, now there's a business. There was nothing there, now there's a new customer. I mean, that's exciting and inherently creative. So I think when you kind of tie your creative efforts back into your business, everything gets better.
And I think that we actually lose that as our business develops, because in the startup phase, we're incredibly creative. Anything is possible. But then as we build our business, we get very much into people and process, which is very important, but we lose some of that creativity and we don't have a chance to step away. I mean, now's the time of year where I go on my 2-week vacation, which is totally analog, non-digital, except for a digital camera. And it's important to be able to step away. I recently had one of my greatest ideas while cycling, and then I implemented the idea. I found out it wouldn't work, but it was incredibly creative and actually spawned something else that ultimately did work.
You're exactly right. I think, you know, for me, this poetry project was kind of a way to get a different part of my brain working. Throughout the years, I'm a musician as well, and playing music was a great way of accessing a different part of my brain. And you're right. When you kind of let that process piece of your brain and the people part of your brain and just the work part of your brain, if you kind of give that a break for a second, there's so many cool ideas that are just bubbling under the surface, ready for you to pay attention to them.
Okay,
and
so
I think that the more you can do that, the better.
So during this interview, I want to have haiku breaks, okay? So can you give us, I'm going to ask you for several sample haikus. So can you give us one that's maybe your favorite?
Oh, man, I have so many that are my favorite. That's the thing when you have 365 to choose from, you have to pick more than one favorite. But
well, we'll get to those, but start with one.
Well, let's see. So one of my ones I really liked is Citywide LMAP, Rainbow Veins Draw to Loop Heart. I am here. Am I?
That's what I ask myself that every day. I'm here, but am I?
Right. Well, and one that is definitely applicable to this time of year, 42 degrees, whether warm or cold, depends on what month it is.
That is absolutely true, because in Chicago in June, right, if it's 50 degrees, you're saying, oh, my God, it's freezing. But if it's December, you're saying it's a heat wave.
Oh, yeah. If it's 42 degrees in March, we walk around in shorts, right?
And some of us never go back. So how did you approach this book? Because you wrote the first 7 books, which were very different. They were about business, you know, about networking and being connected and things like that. And then you write a book on poetry. Did you approach it the same way?
In one very important way, I did. And it's something that I've a habit I've developed over the past couple of years. I write every day. And it's something that I actually stole from Jerry Seinfeld. There's kind of a famous interview he gave where he said, I've got a calendar up on my wall and I have to write a joke every day. When I write a joke, I put an X on the the calendar. My goal is to, you know, get the longest streak I can. And so in writing those first 7 books, what was really valuable is I learned to write every day. And so that's really what I pulled into this project was, okay, I can write a haiku every day. I don't have to write 10 a day or 20 or, you know, just do a weekend of 100, just one a day. And in fact, that's how I tell people all the time. That's how you write a book. You just show up to your typewriter or your computer every day, and eventually you're going to have a book.
Oh, D. Fish, you're aging yourself with that typewriter comment.
Okay, so typewriters, for those of your younger listeners, they're these analog objects that clickety-clack. They're fantastic.
It goes along with that whiteout that no one's ever heard of again, right?
Right.
But I think you bring up a very important point that is very applicable in business. It's this idea of micro-progressing, right? Because you can't write a whole book at one time, but you can do little things and make progress. And that's just the way small business is, right? You take one step, you look at what the result is, then you take another step as a result of that, and you just keep taking these small steps to get to where you want to go. Sometimes the problem is so big, unless we break it down into very, very small steps, we can never make any progress and we get frozen.
Exactly right. Something that I bring into a lot of my conversations with my coaching clients, and something I'm sure you have as well, is if you want to build a big business, you don't do that in a day. It's, you know, how do you have that little win every day? How do you move forward just a little bit in your plan? I think too often we actually get stuck because we just think of like this huge accomplishment we'd like to achieve. And we go, well, I can't see how I get there from here. And then we don't do anything. And so, yeah, just that incremental growth is such a key component, I think, for really anybody's success.
It's very interesting to me because a lot of people say, well, you know, Barry, you've been doing this radio show for 10 years. This past year, you've had Amazon and LinkedIn and SurePayroll and Nextiva as your sponsors. How do I do that? And I say, well, first you got to do the first 400 shows, right?
Right.
And people go, no, I want to skip that phase.
And you can't. And, you know, the old, you know, joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You know, practice. I think it can be damaging because there's unfortunately a lot of people who are kind of in the same business as us who would love to sell you on the fact that there are shortcuts and there are tricks and it's easy to do it. Just, you know, buy my course or buy my book or listen to my seminar. But as you said, you put in the repetition, you put the time in for 10 years and then, yeah, you're going to have some pretty awesome connections, some pretty awesome sponsors, but you got to put the time in first.
You know, I always say that overnight success only takes 8 to 10 years. So now it's a haiku break. Let's have another haiku.
Another one applicable for our time here. Does 0 degrees mean temperature ceases to exist? We're cold.
Wow. I love that one. All right. What about one more before we continue the discussion?
Let's see. Field Museum collects the world in one place. Tourists photograph themselves.
I love that one. Absolutely love that one. So what was the inspiration for writing it around Chicago?
Well, I love the vibrancy of the city. I used to do the poetry slam at the Green Mill Lounge, which was started right here in Chicago. And Mark Smith, who started that, is a Chicago poet and was just an amazing poet at capturing kind of the energy of Chicago. And so that was, and haiku itself is a very observational form. You know, it's 500 years old, but it's really about nature and what we see in the world around us. And I figured, as a city dweller, you know, the city is our nature. The city is our environment and our context. And it's just really fascinating when you pay attention to it. And in fact, the opportunity to really start paying attention to what was around me was probably the biggest thing I got personally from it. You know, the excuse to slow down for a minute every day and look at something was really cool. But and it was fun to kind of bring, again, that vibrancy and that energy of Chicago onto the written page. So I really like that.
All right. So I have one for you, and I'm not sure this is a haiku, but this is posted in the changing room at my karate school. It goes, just as it is, it rains, I get wet, I walk.
Love it.
Is that a haiku? Just as it is, just as it is, it rains, I get wet, I walk.
I think so. I think you're right. I think you've got the right number of syllables.
By a gentleman named Santo, not Santa Claus, Santo Ka. So Tell me about tell me about how you actually bring this creativity into your personal brand offline and online, because I think that, you know, connecting with obviously your audience is so important. And I encourage people to open up. And many ways that people open up is they talk about your creativity and things that they're passionate about to show that they're a whole human being.
Right on. I mean, all of my books before this one were about relationship building and networking and sales. And I really think that it's about bringing your authentic self into your relationships, whether those are personal or professional. I think maybe for a generation or so, we got away from this idea of being human beings. We just tried to be better cogs in the machine. But especially with technology taking over so much of our workspace and the work environment, our ability to bring our humanness into our work world is going to be more and more important. And especially for small business people, like our customers, our vendors, our partners, our prospects, they want to connect with us as people. And as you said, our creativity is one of the things that kind of defines us as a human being. And we all have different interests and different passions. And it's very interesting. I've often found that even if I'm not as interested in a certain area, if a person is passionate about it and they're sharing that passion with me, I'm just as engaged, right? I might not like, 19th century French art, but if somebody's like really fired up about it, I find that conversation really engaging. And so the more we can do that, I think the more effective we are on a professional level, but also it's a much better way of going through the world.
But here's the problem with that, D-Fish, is that a lot of people are afraid. You know, so many of us, and at times I'll include myself, we suffer from this imposter syndrome. I mean, as my wife always says, you know, people really like you when they first meet you, but they've really got to know you. They wouldn't like you so much. And I think that's what people are afraid of.
Right. Well, here's if you're ever afraid of that idea of being an imposter or not being interesting enough, I always go back to a Dale Carnegie quote from How to Win Friends and Influence People. You can make more friends in 2 months being interested in other people than you can in 2 years trying to get other people interested in you. So if you're maybe nervous about sharing your creativity or, you know, things that are interesting to you, get interested in what other people are interested in. And that's just as powerful. In fact, in some ways, that's what makes people like us more, right? People that think we're interesting, we like them.
Absolutely.
People that will listen to us, we like them. So, you know, if there is that fear, that's what I suggest to people. Just flip it and just go out into the world and ask questions and get interested and be curious. And you're going to make some really strong connections. And then when they start asking you about yourself, you're going to feel a lot more comfortable sharing.
And I always tell people that no matter what you're going through, we all share a lot of common experience. So if there's something that you're afraid of or something you struggle with, chances are, D-Fish, that someone else is going through the exact same thing. And by sharing it, you're going to be helping them.
100%. Going to an event, for example, like networking, where we're nervous about meeting new people. The best way of making friends at a networking event is looking at somebody and go, are you nervous to be here too? And they say yes. And you're like, oh, we now have a shared experience and now we're friends. It can be that simple. Yeah, but the human experience is not as complicated as we think it is. We're all experiencing the same emotions, same feelings, same opportunities, and same challenges.
So let's conclude this interview by doing a couple more haikus.
All right. Let's see. So we have this one I think is very Chicago. And lie in bed pre-dawn. Junk man rolls through the alley. I have thoughts for him.
I love that one because I used to live on an alley and I called them the alley people. It was an amazing number of people that basically lived in the alley.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's partly uniquely Chicago with so many alleys that we have.
Yeah. That becomes like part of the experience. See, that wouldn't work if we were in New York. But it works here in Chicago. So again,
all right, D-Fish, leave us with one more.
All right. Well, here's the one for today. Sun slipping under, tomorrow comes from behind. New now comes around. So I have to leave you on a deep one.
It's all good.
For everybody to think about.
The book is called 575, A Daily Glimpse of Chicago Life Seen Through Haiku. Where can people get in touch with you, D-Fish?
They can find me online at davidjpfisher.com, or they can buy the book right at chicago575.com.
All right. Well, happy New Year to you. Have a great 2019.
You too, my friend.
All right. This is AMA 20 WCPT in Chicago. We'll be right back. Whenever I talk to a small business owner, I insist on one function they should always outsource, and that's payroll. You see, payroll is complicated, and both the employee and the government insist that you get it right. You see, when you do payroll, not only do you have to deduct money from the employee's paychecks to remit to the government, but as an employer, you need to add to it. Plus, you need to send this money to various government agencies on a regular basis, and if you don't do it, they will hold you personally liable for it. So this is one thing you gotta stop worrying about. That's why I recommend the new Square Payroll app. With this app, you can do everything from setting up an account to paying your team. It's fully integrated with Square Payments and time cards for W-2 employees and contractors. Square takes care of your tax withholdings, payments, and filings at no extra cost. There is flexible and transparent pricing that scales with your business. So go ahead, search Square Payroll in the Apple iTunes or Google Play app stores to download this app, or visit www.square.com/go/SBR to learn more.
With Barry's 25 years in small business, he has finally discovered the magic formula to make more profit at any company. Business gurus make it seem so complicated, but it is really simple. The formula is P times P equals P, where people multiplied by process means more profit. Learn how you can take a quantum leap in just 180 days to grow the profit in your business. Contact Barry at Maltz.com.
Thinking of starting your own business? Get on board for a crazy ride. Be the first to tweet Barry at Barry Maltz and get a free copy of his book, You Need to Be a Little Crazy, The Truth About Starting and Growing Your Own Business.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Maltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, one of the number one issues that small business owners deal with is how to effectively do sales and marketing. And one of the most overlooked marketing tools that a small business can actually use is the principals in that company going out and speaking to their audience. My next guest is Diane DiResta, CSP. She's the founder and CEO of DiResta Communications, a New York City consultancy serving business leaders who deliver high-stake presentations. Her book is called Knockout Presentations, How to Deliver Your Message with Power, Punch, and Pizzazz. Diane, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Barry.
So one of the things you talk about in the book is that speaking is really the new competitive advantage. Why is that?
Absolutely. Because I've been in this business a long time, and I've seen a shift. And what's different today is that not only is there more competition, but everything has been commoditized. So even if you come up with the latest software, it's just a matter of time before someone can duplicate that. So what sets you apart from the pack is your presentation. They are buying you. And when you present well, you are not only extending your brand, but you're creating that credibility and trust that is so critical to any sale and any relationship.
It's so interesting, Diane, that you point out right up front that, you know, the human voice really can't be duplicated, thank God, right? But they're really buying you. And I think that right there is what stops a lot of people speaking in front of other people, because they're afraid. Because when things are going well, you feel on top of the world. Because I've been there. When things are going poorly, you feel it too. And it doesn't feel so good. So fear stops people from actually using speaking as a marketing tool. What advice do you have for folks that are in that place?
Well, I wrote a whole chapter on fear fixes, but essentially there are two things. You need the right mindset and you need the right skill set. So sometimes people will say to me, Barry, oh, well, it's really just about nervousness. And I said, no, because there's some people who are not nervous, but they're up there blathering on and they're all over the place and they don't realize that they're not making any kind of an impact. So you have to have the skill set. But most of the time, it's because people are not coming out with the right way of thinking. So here's what happens. When someone is really nervous, I know right away that they're being self-centered because they're thinking of everything that can go wrong. Oh, I hope I don't trip. I hope I don't lose my train of thought. So I say to people, get over yourself. It's not about you. It's about the audience. And the other thing that I know, if you're really nervous, is you're not present. You are living in the future, again, because you're thinking of your next line or you're thinking of what could happen. So stay in the moment and be present with people. It's a relationship. Don't give the audience so much power because they're on your side. Nobody wants you to fail. And you have a right to be there because you have some information that they value. So it's interesting. When I work with people, I do a lot of reframing. And it surprised me when I first started telling people to get over themselves how powerful that was for them. And they said, that's like a key takeaway. And it changes their perspective.
For me, Diane, what really gets in the way of so many people being an effective speaker, and you know, Victoria LaBom was my my speaker coach for a very, very long time. And what happens is people are lazy. They don't want to prepare and put the necessary work they have to do actually to put together speech because they see all these people up on stage and they think that they're just naturally just do this. And I have to tell you, there's nothing naturally about it. They've practiced that thing a million times. And so they have to be willing to put the work in. It is a very, to me, and you make this point in the book, it's a very cost-effective and powerful marketing tool. But just like anything else, you have to put the work in up front.
And I always say it's 90% preparation and only 10% delivery. I'm a member of National Speakers Association, and I see this attrition rate. People come in and they're excited and they want this glamorous speaking career. And then they see what it takes and they don't last. It is really hard work, but it's so worth it. And especially if you're using speaking as a marketing tool, it's one of the most powerful and cost-effective ways that you can market because let's face it, as small business owners, we can't compete with big budget companies. So we're not going to be putting out these huge advertisings and ads, but we can speak and reach a large audience. And it is really powerful.
You know, there's different things between people that are professional speakers like you and I, and then people that are running a company, and every once in a while they go out and they're on a panel at a trade show or they speak. How would you suggest they prepare because they're not doing speaking for a living?
Well, absolutely. And so for no matter who you are or what you do, I would say first get trained in it. And there is a level for everybody. You can go to Toastmasters. You can read a book. But if it's high stakes, I would definitely work with a coach and help them, get them to help you not only with the delivery, but with the crafting of the message because it is a really high-stakes situation when even when you're on a panel because that's your brand. And here's the power of speaking as a marketing tool. When they see you, they think of you as the expert. So it's like test driving a car. And what you're doing is lowering the barrier to entry because they're getting a sense of what they would get if they were to work with you. Now, the mistake people make is they expect a quick hit. Oh, I was on the panel, so why aren't people asking me to speak or to buy my product? But what happens is if you continue that follow-up and you build a relationship over time, you'll see that your sales start to increase. But it is a really great way because the next time they're thinking of that service that they need, they're going to think of you because they heard you speak.
There's no question about that. But every once in a while, the planets do align. Earlier this month, I was in New York for an SAP partner conference, and I sat down with two gentlemen, one from Cintas, which is this, you know, billion-dollar uniform delivery rental company, and another company who happened to be in Chicago called Nimble, which was a $20 million systems integrator. And at an SAP conference, the owner of the company gets up, talks about what they're doing as far as system integration, and after he got done speaking, someone from Cintas, the CIO, came over and said, hey, I'd really like to talk to you about this. Can I buy you a drink? And from there, a huge relationship spawned that really ended up being, for this small business, one of their major customers and really enabled them someday to sell their business. So it does happen.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. And I can give you two examples, an immediate and a long term. I was speaking one time at a conference on behavioral styles. A woman came up to me and said, "Do you do this for corporations?" I said, "Yes." Are you available May 17th? "Yes." "Okay, you're hired. Now, when you get back to your office, would you send me a proposal?"
Unbelievable.
I love clients like that.
Exactly.
That rarely happens. But in 2014, I got a call from a company in Tennessee, and the woman said, "I would like to work with you. I come to New York regularly." And I said, "Fine. How did you hear of me?" "Well, about 10 years ago, I heard you speak at a women's group." "Really? Do you remember which one?" "Well, no. That's a client today, but we still don't know how we first connected. But she heard me speak 10 years ago." So I'm telling everybody, this is really powerful. Don't get discouraged if it doesn't happen immediately.
Yeah, people have to understand that this kind of thing has a very long tail. I got a similar call a couple of weeks ago. A woman had seen me speak 5 years ago in Denver, and she goes, "Yeah, I remember you help people get unstuck. I'm finally stuck, so I thought I'd call you."
It's so true. We all know in sales, people do things when it's ready, their time, when they're ready to do it, not on your time. And that's what we need to do. But in the interim, we can be planting all those seeds. So think about this. What would you rather do? One cold call at a time, or getting in front of a group of people for about 20 minutes? You get so many more leads, you get so much more exposure, and you don't even know who's in that audience and who's telling somebody else about you. So I encourage everybody. I say today that you cannot be without this skill, whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you are in the workplace. It is a leadership skill. It is a selling skill. You've got to master it.
So, Diane, if you're a small business owner listening right now and you've never done this, where do you, and you want to, do you believe, yeah, Diane and Barry are right, it's a great marketing tool we're not using, where do you start?
There are a number of ways you can start. The smallest way, the quickest first step would be to read a book. Get a book on public speaking. You mentioned knockout presentations. I'll tell you, it is the Bible of public speaking. Another thing you can do is go on to YouTube. There are so many videos there where you can start to learn some of the skills. You can join Toastmasters, which is an organization of people who get together and practice speeches, and that's Toastmasters.org. You can call a coach, and I do that with people. I run workshops, and I run one-on-one coaching, and they can help you overcome your fear but also get your thoughts together and help you with your slides and the whole presentation itself. So that's where I would start. Start small. Start with a book. Get some of the concepts, the skills. Start looking at some videos. You can go to TED.com. Start watching good speakers. TED Talks are a great way to do it. But here's the truth, Barry. At a certain point, you have to bite the bullet and you have to do it. You mentioned that in an earlier talk I was listening to. You can't just read about it or look at it. You have to get on your feet and do it.
It's interesting. You mentioned two things that are really close to my heart. One is really practice. You got to get up there and you've got to practice. And one of the best ways to do it really is Toastmasters, because it's a very small investment, but they get you to speak. The other thing is you've got to get on stage and actually do the presentation, because you can practice all you want, Diane. But I always say that a certain presentation I'm going to do doesn't get really good until I present it in front of a live audience 100 times.
Exactly. So here's another tip. Practice in front of a few friends. Get a group together, probably not family, but friends that you trust, who will give you encouragement and honest feedback, and practice it that way so you get the feel of an audience. Another way you can get your feet wet is start with a webinar or a teleconference, so that you're not face-to-face and you're not as scared or nervous, but you're getting the sense of the rhythm and the practice and the timing. Then try a panel or do something where you have a co-trainer, co-speaker. So if you're talking about a small business service, maybe you have someone who has a complimentary service and you take turns speaking to the group, and start small. Don't go for an hour. Go for a 15 or 20 minute talk. Do things like Rotary clubs or dinners, small groups. Start with groups that are low risk. So one place you could try is the public library. You know, if you bomb, you know, if that's not your market, it's not a big deal. And then work up to the higher stakes clients that you want.
I really like this idea. And again, it's micro progressing, right? It's like taking the smaller steps just to practice it, get in front of people through a panel where maybe you're not the only one up on stage, and then doing a small presentation. We're not talking about the first presentation you do, go get up there on stage, you're the only one there, and you're doing it in front of 2,000 people.
Exactly. And here's another variation of that. Some people get nervous about knowing the content and they're going to forget what they say. So ask for fireside chat. Do an interview in front of a group with a good moderator. And what that moderator will do, just like you're doing, is pull out the content from you in interview format. And that's interesting, it's conversational, and it's a lot less stressful.
You know, I there's two things that I always live by when I'm speaking. The first one is Dale Carnegie about being nervous. He says, we can't make those butterflies in our stomach go away. We just need to teach them to fly in formation. And I love that. And the last thing Victoria always taught me was, you know, whatever, you know, if you're nervous or whatever's going on with you, if you can't hide it, you should feature it. And I love that, because when you feature it, you actually get it out there and you're able to let it go.
Exactly. Name the elephant in the room, because what's happening is you're using all of this energy to prevent being nervous, and then you it really backs up against you. I saw someone who did this beautifully. He was a management consultant, had a good reputation, was a known author in his industry, but he wasn't a dynamic speaker. So what he did is he announced to the audience that, yeah, he's been practicing his presentation skills for years. He's taken classes. He said, you know, I'm not a very dynamic speaker. They tell me I need to use more gestures. Then he gestured and said, see, there's a gesture.
Exactly.
People laughed. And you know what? He was very effective in his low-key, self-deprecating style. So I would say to people, take what is you and be you and leverage it. Don't try to be something that you're not. And if you're nervous, name the elephant.
Absolutely. Well, Diane, I appreciate you being on the show. The title of the book is called Knockout Presentations, How to Deliver Your Message with Power, Punch, and Pizzazz. And where can people get in touch with you?
Diresta.com, D as in David, I-R-E, S as in Sam, T as in Thomas, A. Diresta.com. You can find my book there and online.
Well, Diane, I want to wish you a happy new year, and I want to wish everyone else listening to a happy new year for 2019. I want to thank all of you for listening to the show. I got to thank our sponsor, Nextiva, the all-in-one communication solutions for small business. I also got to thank our booking producer, Sarah Shaffrin, our in-studio producer, Lady B, our marketing manager, Courtney Gilchrist. Guess what? 2019 is just around the corner. This is your year to get unstuck and finally make the money that you deserve. This is why you got into small business. You got to give me a call, 773-837-8250, or email me at barry@maltz.com. Remember, love everyone, trust a few, and paddle your own canoe. Have a profitable and passionate new year.
You can find Barry Maltz on the web at barrymaltz.com, or more episodes of Small Business Radio at smallbizradioshow.com.